Thank you all for coming. For the record, this is the LCC's Subcommittee on Data Practices. And also for the record, the meeting today is on September 5th, 2019. We have an agenda today. We will be reviewing a bill that we've been working on regarding unmanned aerial vehicle language and hopefully making a recommendation to the legislature formally today. Since the last meeting, a number of us were working with stakeholders as well as with government officials to sand down the original language and improve it. And Representative Lesch, I, and the research teams on both caucuses in the House and Senate worked together and listened to direction from the BCA as well as from the ACLU. And we will have the bill presentation in front of us shortly, but before we do that, could I have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting on July 24th? Senator Clausen so moves. All those in favor say aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. We're going to be moving on to a document of, it's SC5562-3. That's the bill that is a modified version of what we looked at the last meeting. There is a document in your file, and it looks something like this. It looks like a side-by-side. We're familiar with that type of thing when we review conference committees. On the left side of that document is the original document, and the one on the right is the one that we modified and presenting for approval today. You can follow either one of them if you wish. I'm going to ask Priya to give us a review of the new document and if there's any notable changes from the first document. Or perhaps we can wait for questions if that's better.
Mr. Chair, members, I could review the substantive changes that were made since the last meeting of the subcommittee. And just to help you follow along with some of the changes as discussions continue, there is the side-by-side, which includes the highlighted language changes. But I'll be presenting from the SC5562-3, the actual bill draft, if you'd like to follow along. On most of the substantive changes are on pages 1 through 3. And starting on page 1, line 7, there's a new section which authorizes law enforcement to release otherwise private or non-public UAV data to aid in the law enforcement process, promote public safety, or dispel widespread rumor or unrest. This is similar to how we treat body camera data. Section 2, line 1.13, is also a new section. It adds a cross-reference in Chapter 13 to this new UAV data statute. Page 2. Line 4, there's a new definition defining government entity. Page 2, line 13, there are several changes, substantive and structural, made to subdivision 3 on authorized uses when a law enforcement agency can use a UAV without a search warrant. So line 2.14, makes some changes to a previous exception, emergency situation. Page 2, line 16, makes a change to when a law enforcement agency can use a UAV over a public event. Previously, it was substantial risk, and now it's been changed to heightened risk. Page 2, line 23 through 28 have...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Newman.
Would you prefer that Priya go through the entire document before questions or ask questions as we go?
We're almost through with some of the major changes, so I would suggest we go through the entire bill proposal, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair, members, so page 2, line 23 through 28 have new exceptions. They include a exception to conduct a threat assessment in anticipation of a specific event, to collect information from a public area if there's reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, to collect information for crash reconstruction purposes following a serious or deadly collision, and for public relations purposes. Page 3, line 11 through 14 includes a new subdivision. However, portions of this subdivision requiring documentation were present in other pieces of the bill draft when the subcommittee saw it at the July 24th meeting. There are some technical changes in the remainder of the bill, but they don't necessarily have a substantive effect and were mainly changes to reflect where the report should go, which committee should see it, and those are highlighted in your side-by-side as well. If there are any specific questions, I'm happy to answer them.
We'll open it up for questions. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got three basic questions that I'd like to pose. First of all, line 2.18, under authorized use to counter the risk of a terrorist attack. Is terrorist attack defined anywhere? And the reason I ask is, you know, it would seem to me there would be a foreign terrorist attack, possibly a domestic terrorist attack, or instead of a terrorist attack, just a criminal act. And I would think we'd want to somehow define that. And my question is it defined in the bill anywhere?
Okay. Ms. Primo?
Mr. Chair, members, it is not defined in the bill anywhere, and I'm not sure if it is in statute. My understanding was this might be something that law enforcement would use their own guidance and other authority, including perhaps federal statutes, to make the decision about whether this threat rose to that level leading to a UAV. I can look and see if there's something that adds a little bit more guidance in our statutes as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My thought would be is that if a terrorist attack or countering the risk of a terrorist attack is one of the reasons for the authorized use, then I think that we should have a definition. Then, Mr. Chairman, under line beginning 2.29, non-law enforcement purposes at the request of a government entity. I see that that particular request has to be made to law enforcement. It has to be made in writing, and they have to state a reason why they are requesting the use. But I don't see any criteria as to when the request of a government entity should be approved or allowed by law enforcement. And I'm not sure if I missed it. Maybe it's in there. But if not, then I would suggest that there should be criteria as to when law enforcement is authorized to proceed at the request of a government entity, which is a state agency or, you know, that type of entity. So that's my question, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, at line 2.31, when the government entity makes the request, they must also specify the proposed period of use. I'm not sure if that might inform when, a little bit of when law enforcement would put the would use the UAV and for how long, and whether that would satisfy Senator Nguyen's concerns. But other than that specific phrasing, there's nothing else that specifically addresses the timeline period for a law enforcement when it comes to this specific exception.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It would seem to me that if we are going to allow a state agency to request the use of a drone, that we ought to be providing law enforcement with the necessary criteria in order to make the decision as to whether or not to allow it.
I would be
concerned with more than just the time period that was mentioned. So that would be a suggestion on my part. The third and last question I would have, Mr. Chairman, would be on page 4. Under beginning at line 4.4, under remedies. And if I am reading this correctly, an aggrieved party can bring a civil action against law enforcement for any remedies that are available under Chapter 13. Then it goes on to say, and to obtain all appropriate relief to remedy a violation in this section. In my estimation, the phrase all appropriate relief is far too broad. We should specify in this bill what that relief is that the aggrieved party is seeking. That relief could come in the form of an injunction to prohibit action. It could come in the form of an action to require enforcement. It could come in the form of certain damages, but I would think not all damages. The word exemplary damages is used quite often in the bill, and I don't know if that would be appropriate in terms of damages or not. I think that would be for the committee to discuss. I would think general damages would not be appropriate. So what I'm getting at is that I think the phrase all appropriate relief is simply an ambiguous term, and if we are going to allow an aggrieved party to bring an action, I think we have to state exactly what that aggrieved party can expect in the way of relief provided by the court. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman, could you tell me what exemplary relief would be? You mentioned that in your discussion.
Mr. Chairman, that rather highlights my thought as to why we should be more definite. I believe that often exemplary damages are triple damages, but maybe not necessarily. I don't think it means punitive damages. If there is a statutory definition of it, I don't know. I haven't taken the time to look it up.
All right.
But it does highlight why we should maybe be more definite. If we're going to allow exemplary damages, then I think we should make a cross-reference to wherever it is defined in the statute.
Yeah. Ms. Primo, do you have any reference on the term exemplary relief?
Mr. Chair, members, generally exemplary damages refers to some sort of punitive damages. I will note that the bill itself does not use the term exemplary, but however, 13.08, which is the civil remedies section provided in Chapter 13, has a lot more specificity as well as a specific cap of what the exemplary damages are in the case of a willful violation of Chapter 13. If this is just a proposal, and I'm not sure where the stakeholders are on this matter, but we could specifically cite to 13.08 and limit the remedies that are available to a party who is in some way damaged by a violation of this section to the remedies in 13.808, which include injunctive relief, which include an action to compel compliance, and an action for damages, include additional recuperation of damages for specific set amounts. So that's one thought or one direction that the committee could go.
All right. Anyone wishing to add to this discussion? Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Senator Newman. I think that it's a little bit vague, maybe a tad bit of an overreach on it. And I think our remedies that we have according to Chapter 13 are probably sufficient for this. If there is something else that happens, I think they could take up a separate action. My question is regarding lines 2.29 about the non-law enforcement purpose at the request of a government entity. And it talks about that they have to make a request in writing to the law enforcement agency. And I think you cleaned it up from the last time where it was just basically saying make a request in writing. I guess I would like staff to kind of go over if you make the request to writing to law enforcement or to the government entity, so if it would be the county sheriff, that would be to the county board. What do you expect the county board or the city council, if it's a city of Minneapolis and they have a drone and they're making a request? I guess I'm not only asking the members of the committee, but also staff to maybe elaborate a little bit on why. What is the point? What do you want them to do? What action do you want that local government to do with that information? I'm just confused at why that is in there. It's one thing to notice that, you know, we're going to use the drone for something non-law enforcement related, but I guess I'm just saying, like, why is it in writing to a government entity is maybe my best way to articulate my question versus just documenting it and turning it over in the annual report that is now requested.
Anyone wish to answer that? Ms. Primo?
Mr. Chair and members.
We're going to the default answerer, Ms. Primo.
I believe this exception was added, and the scenario that came up was if, for example, a Parks and Rec board wanted some type of, you know, was planning a project or having an event of some sort and needed a UAV to help inform their planning or something like that, they could then specify that request in writing and to law enforcement, so law enforcement would then have some sort of idea of exactly what or when or how many officers or how many drones they may need, and then collect that data and turn it over to the government entity for them to then use that in whatever manner they needed. And when the data goes to that specific government entity that's not a law enforcement agency, that is governed by the general Chapter 13 statute. So if that data would be private or public under for Parks and Rec, which it probably would be public because there's no specific classification for them, then they could use that, or the public could access that, and it would be and they could keep it pursuant to their own normal routine retention policies. There's no further limitation that's provided, at least not in this bill, about how that how that specific entity uses that data.
So, Mr. Chair.
Sir Bigham.
I guess just some consideration is if we're already asking in the new language to have the annual report of the maintains, uses, and plans to use side of the language of the bill, it seems duplicative if it's a non-law enforcement use that we would then also have that in writing to law enforcement when they already have to track it anyway. And so I guess I would like to work on some different language for that issue. And we don't have to hash it out right now, but maybe I can meet with staff after I have a call. But I just think if Parks and Recs, and we already laid out there, like if it's for reconstruction or for publicity or whatever, we already kind of have some of that stuff taken care of, but I think we have to flush that out a little bit. I'm happy to do that with staff after.
Sir, or Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bingham. I know that the language that was placed in there, as it stands, without, I guess, a real solid reason, doesn't make a lot of sense to me to modify. You know, if a municipality wants to engage in activities that potentially invade the privacy of their residents and do so in a way that could potentially make that private information public data without a data classification, the governmental entity should have to think about that ahead of time. Why? Why do you want to do this? Without this language in place, the governmental entity doesn't need to say, okay, well, we just want to fly over the park and see how many trees we have. It's the same example that a law enforcement agency has to do when they apply for a warrant to surveil. They have to spell out the specific parameters. Geographic, the timeline of what's within the purview of what they're going to grab. Because in that case, with criminal data, it's protected by under the Fourth Amendment. In this data, citizens or residents have no protections, none, that their private data could be exposed to public view because of lack of a data classification, or even without the, even if it is protected, there's still someone else who sees it who doesn't have the right to see it. So I think this language is going to force a governmental entity to actually look before they leap and think before they act, to actually have to spell out, okay, why do we want to do this, rather than just tossing a UAV up there. And it is comfort language for me, but at some point, I'm sure Mr. Chair will probably have proponents of this language maybe speak to it as to why they think it's important and could probably say so better than me.
All right. Thank you. Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch. So I don't necessarily disagree with anything you said. I think that that's already covered by the report that is done every year, that the law enforcement has to say every time those were used. Unless I'm misunderstanding that you want them to tell you in a report by June 15th of every year the uses of the drone. And if the Parks and Rec group or the city forester wants to go in and go over their city land to look at the trees, which would be a use and probably a very cost-effective use for them, that would be documented already in the annual report that was done, and then the public and the city can go through and say, hey, maybe we don't need to do that again this year, or, hey, we aren't going to use the drone for that purposes anymore because it's not getting us what we need, the information that we need. We're going to have to go put boots on the ground and count the trees. I'm just saying, I think it's already covered. I think it's duplicative, and I guess I don't, if anything, then maybe we should request that the cities have a discussion about the report that they will be submitting versus having the Parks and Rec group submit in writing to law enforcement every time they want to use it, or the Public Works I think there's a different way to get at the same information that I think we both agree should maintain private.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I would only say to that, Senator Bigham, it may just reveal a philosophical difference between me and you, but, you know, as everyone knows, it's much better to beg forgiveness than to ask permission, right? And submitting a report at the end of the year about how we screwed up in invading privacy is much easier than having to think about how we might ahead of time. And a lot of these folks, you know, it's not their job to think about that. I mean, they think about rings on trees and whatever, and so I want them to have to maybe just consider it for a second ahead of time, but it might just be a philosophical difference.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that note, I do have a couple of other questions, but on that note, the value of having that in there, in my opinion, is that it leaves somewhat of a paper trail or an electronic trail, whatever, so that if there is an issue later, even though it may be stated in that report at the end of the year that this was done, we have a why and a what for and a whom. And so I think it's essential to keep it in. On another issue, I had questions for the Senator Limmer and Lesch. I know that you met with the stakeholders on changing the language and tweaking it. And I'm wondering on lines 2.28, if there's how you arrived at the public relations purposes, and is that defined in statute? I don't want that to be overly broad. And I'm just wondering if you recall during those conversations the onus behind it.
Representative Scott, we did talk with Drew Evans from BCA regarding public relations. And our discussion really was down a rather innocent use of a drone. Let's say you have a public festival, a city festival of some sort, and you have a lot of emergency equipment set up in a park, and kids are climbing through an ambulance or going through a squad car to see what that's all about. And for at least the example we were given, public relations purpose would be someone flying a drone up and down and maybe taking a picture down on the festival event to show the community the equipment that they might have. I don't think we got into too much more than that. It was just that, and that's why we just plinked in the public relations purpose. We do not, as far as I know, have a definition anywhere in state law regarding that, and I don't know how much we want to limit it or constrain it. So open for suggestions.
Okay. Thank you. And I agree with
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Newman, I think that the language regarding all appropriate relief, it should be discussed further, not necessarily narrowing it, but the purposes for putting all appropriate relief in there, I'm interested as to why that was added, and 'cause to me, there should have been a purpose for adding that. Otherwise, we would have known that anything, all the penalties under Chapter 13 would have governed this section. So I think that more discussion probably needs to be made to that wording.
What line are you on?
Oh, I'm sorry. The end of 4.5 and then 4.6, the all appropriate relief.
On the modified version,
right,
of the legislation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I see it. All right. I believe it was in the original bill, lines, okay, 316 through 318.
Okay.
I'm sure there was someone in the audience that would want to address this, okay, as well. So, okay. Ms. Primo, do you have any reference to Senator Scott's question?
Mr. Chair and members, that phrasing was in the original bill when it was SF 1430, mm-hmm, that was heard by at least the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I believe that was a stakeholder agreement of some sort, at least at that point, that had been around. So I'm not sure when there was an agreement to add that sort of maybe boilerplate phrasing to the section. Maybe one of the stakeholders could speak to that.
Representative Scott, I believe this was a request or a part of the bill that the ACLU was in support of, and they were in the meeting that we had in order to modify some of this language. So they were part of it. I believe they're in the room, and they have requested a moment to give testimony today on this bill.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And we'll get to them a little later.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to add two items that I see here that could be for a future discussion, or maybe as this after it's recommended and travels the committees of each body. The first that I see is line 2.14 on the revised copy. During or in the aftermath of an emergency situation that involves the risk of death or bodily harm. What stuck out at me is that those are both ends of the spectrum, death, and then it's my understanding, and maybe some of the lawyers here could correct me, but my understanding is bodily harm is the lowest of the threshold of harm to another. And so the way that it's worded right now, we go from death all the way, which is the highest end of the continuum, all the way to the lowest. And is that the intent for the criteria for that provision? And then it appears the same thing happens on line 2.26 and 2.27, which is for crash reconstruction, we go from serious or deadly collision. So is serious the lowest end of the continuum all the way up to, obviously, deadly collision? So is that intentional? Is that what we want, or do we want to potentially modify those criteria? And then the next item that I see is on line 2.24, to collect information from a public area if there is reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. Well, criminal activity is pretty broad, and we could apply, if we simply have to apply the threshold of reasonable suspicion to the potential of criminal activity, that, again, is extremely broad. And is that intentional, or do we want to potentially be more clarifying in what type of criminal activity? Thank you.
Representative Lucero, at least on your last question regarding reasonable suspicion, I believe you were at the last meeting and we had the BCA and other law enforcement officials here explaining what reasonable suspicion means in existing law right now. It's not anything new. There are standards of which govern the play of police surveillance. And in my opinion, some of them are rather broad, but case law has allowed police officials to have a rather wide authority to look into someone's backyard or over a field or even walk onto a field and examine what might be, let's say, behind a tree hedge of some sort. Once you start getting into the actual domicile of the person or the immediate, I think the word was curtilage, the immediate area around that dwelling, then that starts getting into the need for a search warrant. But reasonable suspicion, we did have a discussion on, perhaps there's someone in the audience that might be able to make reference. I also had a concern when this was in the Judiciary Committee last session with the use of reasonable suspicion, but I've done a little research on it, talked to the experts in this field, and reasonable suspicion is part of our existing law and a long history of it. Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, my concern was not reasonable suspicion. I was there for that conversation. That wasn't, so just to clarify my remarks, that's not my concern. My concern is the criminal activity. It's criminal activity can be anything from a petty misdemeanor, to a felony. And so there's a lot of low-end misdemeanors, but as I'm reading this language, criminal activity, this would be all-inclusive of every criminal activity. And is that the intent? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I would just ask, because I was not there for the conversation, the reasonable suspicion is the Terry v. Ohio standard in existing law, but existing law includes reasonable articulable suspicion. Is there a reason why, can anyone recall if there was a reason why we left out the articulable portion? I mean, my expectation is that a court would impute that anyway, but does anyone know the answer to that? And if not, that's fine. I was just curious.
Representative Lesch, I don't think the word articulable came up in our discussion.
Okay.
And so I'd even have to have you give me a definition of what that word means. But I know for a fact we did not use that word in our discussion on modifying this language.
Understood, Ms. Chair. You know, and under current standard for the reasonable suspicion stop, such as a Terry stop, and this is, you know, of course, seizure of a person, which is this language is not limited to, you need to be able to have a reasonable suspicion, but then you need to be able to articulate it so it goes beyond a hunch, or under State ex rel Tahash v. Rasmussen, mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity, which the articulable suspicion satisfies, but it's not something I want to jump on now because I'm sure it will come up if we grind this through committee later on. But I just wanted to raise the question in case anyone knew. That was all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero, to your question regarding did we did we want to subdivide or be specific on criminal activity? No. We wanted to give law enforcement at least a reasonable wide path in order to investigate or at least pursue a reasonable suspicion of some criminal activity and to observe it and then decide what they wish to do with it. So, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
It's been
a few months since the session. What's his name over there?
I just have a question under Subdivision 6, the data classification, the retention issue, where on line 3.29 it talks about law enforcement agency must delete data collected by a UAV as soon as possible and in no event later than 7 days, which seems to be rather short period of time, especially when you look at body cameras, ALPRs, they're talking about 60 to 90 days. Seems to me if someone is requesting from the public to take a look at that, it could take well over 7 days for that to become possible. And so I'm just wondering how we landed on 7 days, and is that something we should take a look at, extending that?
Ms. Primo, do you recall why we arrived at the 7 days?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that was a stakeholder agreement. The initial draft that was heard in the Senate earlier this past session said that the data had to be deleted within 24 hours. So I believe this was part of some continuing conversation that went on among the stakeholders.
Okay. I think I'm going to move. Are there any other specific questions? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not a question, but just to answer the senator's point. When it comes to government potentially collecting information on citizens that is private information, that, and as we read the language, is not part of an active investigation, we want government to purge that ASAP. And 7 days, I guess, is, in my opinion, even longer than it should be. But if there's no need for the information that government has captured, private information, we don't want to hang on to it for longer, is my point. Thank you.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if there's a civil action that wants to be brought against another party and it's been captured on tape? And if we're deleting it in 7 days, that seems to be a short period of time.
Representative Lucero.
I guess my immediate answer, Mr. Chair, would be under most of these, there wouldn't. This is involving law enforcement, and law enforcement isn't, for the most part, dealing with civil actions. Mm-hmm. And so this is dealing with criminal actions and criminal standards, a reasonable suspicion, et cetera. So if there's a party to a civil action, I guess they'd have to do what they do now, absent that footage.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that in the discussions, the superintendent of the BCA opined, and he, of course, can confirm for himself, that 7 days was enough for them on this. And I would just add in that we, in collecting this data, have a balancing test on this, because the more of this data on Minnesotans that we collect, the more of it is subject to breach. And unless I think we have a compelling interest to retain it, I would prefer that we get rid of it so that it is not subject to those data breaches for which we may be potentially liable. So I don't know how much we've paid out on breaches for stuff that we do legal collect and create data sets for right now, but the more that we add on, the more I think that we are potentially on the hook for on breaches. So I would prefer that time be shorter to avoid that liability unless we know of a reason that we should retain it.
I'm going to ask one of the people in the audience if they might be able to give us some insight onto this particular issue. Superintendent Evans, I'm going to call you down. Perhaps you can give us a recall on the 7-day retention. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I think it's a combination of what's been said here today. I think in the original bill and the discussion with the ACLU, and as Representative Lesch has indicated, there was a concern about holding data on individuals if it is not related to a criminal investigation. And so the example that was used in the discussion is if we're utilizing them in one of these, say, the heightened risk for public safety needs is one of the provisions, that recording may be there in case a criminal activity occurs or an attack or an active shooter were to occur. But once that is determined it's not happened, to not retain that data on individuals, and so we need to delete it. That 7-day period was an agreement with the stakeholders, as said, to make sure that there's no need for a law enforcement purpose. I understand the question, and it's a little bit different if the public wanted to access that information. But for us, that was enough of a time period to determine if we needed that data for a criminal investigation, and then it would be deleted and not held on individual citizens. All right.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch talked about liability, and I'm wondering, what if that liability is justified by a citizen, in other words, brings a suit against law enforcement based upon actions that have been recorded, and if you've erased that after 7 days, perhaps that null and voids the issue.
Any comment, Superintendent?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a short period of time, certainly in terms of the amount of time you'd be holding the information we would have. If there was a notification of a data request during that time period, I don't think you would simply erase it. I think you would then need to respond and hold that data. In terms of your civil action, obviously in most instances, if somebody's going to commence a civil action, it's usually going to be beyond 7 days. But again, the goal with that retention period was to protect the privacy interest of citizens. I don't think we had a specific concern about a certain retention period. It was trying to ensure we're not holding data in non-criminal investigatory a manner to protect that information.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to have this reviewed, especially in light of existing statute dealing with body cameras and ALPRs and some of the issues that we've raised today. I think a review of this is perhaps in order.
Could you repeat that? I was talking with Representative Lesch.
Yes. What I was asking, I think a review of this issue should, the retention issue should be something that we further investigate. When you look at the body camera and ALPR's language dealing with retention, it's a much longer period of time. Issues about civil judgments against parties outside of law enforcement, also liability of law enforcement and actions in a particular situation. It just seems to me we should be keeping this information longer than 7 days. It just seems to be a rather short period of time.
Members, there was a paper made by Ms. Primo regarding a comparison of body camera data, LPR data, and in the proposal on the drone language in your file. And so it's a pretty good, in a capsule form, a pretty good rendition, easy to read, easy to compare. So it's a good question to ask whether or not we want to bring uniformity to this or not. The reason why I asked you to repeat your question, I was asking Representative Lesch, what happens now if there would be a possible civil action and one needed to gain information from a government record that has already been sealed or expunged or just destroyed? And the answer was, well, you're kind of out of luck. And I'm not sure if that isn't a bad idea either. There's two sides to this, too. The question of retaining data, as we've been told by any time we go down this path, it's very expensive and it's cumbersome. And it could also open to more civil litigation that may or may not be legitimate. So there's always the balance that we're trying to find here, but you raise good questions. Probably something that can't be answered in our short time today. Thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you.
We do have public testimony of Julia Decker from the ACLU that wishes to come and give added testimony today. If there's anyone else who wishes to make comment, please let us know. I'll be asking for others to come down in the next few minutes. Ms. Decker.
Mr. Chair and members, Julia Decker, Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're pleased that the subcommittee is reviewing this bill again today. Some of you may know this version is the result of many number of years of negotiations, a lot of work with stakeholders, addressing stakeholder concerns on all sides of this issue of drones regulation. ACLU of Minnesota approaches this issue from the standpoint of protecting individual privacy rights. And while acknowledging that there may not be a full expectation of privacy every time in public, we also don't expect to be under secret warrantless government surveillance every time we step out our front doors, just in case we do something wrong. And traditional technology, things like helicopters, don't have the same potential for that type of surveillance as drones do. Throughout this process, though, we also did learn about the more powerful and innovative ways that drones are already being used. And so the bill has been narrowed over time as we've worked with stakeholders to assess how best to balance individual privacy rights with the public safety uses of drones. Nevertheless, the bill does some very important things that we want to highlight. It establishes as a baseline law enforcement needs to get a warrant to use a drone unless a specific exception applies. It lays out some guideposts to curb the potential for this secret warrantless drone surveillance by law enforcement. And it also promotes transparency through the documentation and reporting requirements. This warrant requirement, the guideposts, the transparency, these are all very important and necessary to protect individual privacy rights, particularly in the face of a very powerful, pervasive, and rapidly developing technology such as drones. So the ACLU of Minnesota supports this bill as very timely and as the result of a lot of work, a lot of negotiations. We look forward to hopefully seeing it pass this year in 2020.
Ms. Decker, I have a question.
Yes.
There's a lot of discussion about the remedies found on at least the modified version 4.4 through 4.6. Senator Newman raised questions earlier today regarding the what he believes is an overly broad remedy that's or for appropriate relief. And do you have any comment on it? I believe you were in on our working meeting. And do you have any comment about defining the appropriate relief in addition to 13.08 reference?
Mr. Chair, principally the ACLU wants there to be teeth in this bill. And so to have a provision regarding remedies is something that principally we agree with. It sounds like there can be an ongoing discussion about how best to define that. But as a principal matter, the ACLU wants there to be teeth for enforcement of this provision.
Right. Are there any questions for this testifier? Ms. Primo?
Mr. Chair, members, not a question, but since we're on this topic, I did look up a few other statutes, and it seems like the phrasing appropriate relief does appear in several other statutes that authorize civil action. Some of the phrasing includes injunctive relief or other appropriate relief as determined by the court, sort of in that way, so that if that further informs the committee's ongoing discussion.
Well, I suppose the question would be is do we want to rely on the way previous legislatures have written or defined the game of play when it comes to a civil action? I've been around here a long time, and I know that there's been certain times in the legislature where things have been rather written rather broadly for the benefit of action in a court, and it was brought on by a time when trial lawyers were very dominant in the legislature and their influence. I don't know if we want to continue that domination or not, but it is something that I believe that Senator Newman has raised an appropriate question on regarding do we want to be a little bit more specific in this case. So that's a question for all of us to discuss and ponder a little bit before we make recommendation. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if you have a comment on the retention discussion we've had. If you could comment on that, we'd appreciate it.
Ms. Decker.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clausen, regarding the 7 days retention, as Superintendent Evans mentioned, this was an agreement with the stakeholders. We did discuss it. It sounds like maybe there will be further discussion about that. Principally, we, again, in the spirit of protecting individual privacy rights, believe that a limit on retaining data is necessary to protect individual privacy rights.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions for this testifier? Representative Lesh.
You guys, you sent it in your switches. See, in the House, we're always on, okay? So you
yeah,
can
we
hear
don't
us
like that.
Sneeze and cough, okay? All right. So on the remedies portion, I don't know if the public wants to gain the impression that we're trying to limit remedies more so than what's already existing in the Data Practices Act. I don't know if there's anyone on the committee that would argue that the current remedies under the Data Practices Act are adequate to prevent breaches. We have paid out millions in breaches so far over the course of the past 5 years, and I'm open to a conversation about that, but dominance of trial lawyers or not, notwithstanding, if I'm one of those victims that has had my private data breached, and I don't know if any of them are in the audience here today, but I know they've been written up in the paper extensively for the last few years, I'm certainly not going to say that there are adequate remedies already, or the remedies are onerous. So I guess I would argue, to the extent we're going forward, that I think this is an agreement. The parties have reached an agreement, including that provision in Subdivision 8, and I don't think it needs to be changed.
Okay. Any other discussion or questions for this testifier? I'd like to thank you, Ms. Decker. I'd like to ask Superintendent Evans to come down again, or perhaps anyone else from law enforcement that raised the question of remedies. Superintendent, you were looking for someone else in the audience, but we did have a question on the remedies, and I was wondering if law enforcement, this apparently is language that was reached by a mutual kind of discussion or agreement, and did you have any further comment to make on this?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the language, as we said here, certainly is implementable by the BCA, I will say, and I think the question was raised by some of the other law enforcement partners in the discussions we did have. I indicated in there, I certainly don't speak on behalf of law enforcement, and some of the other coalitions did express some concerns about the remedy language and did want to have some further discussions about that from there on that.
Right. Thank you. Is there anyone else from the law enforcement community who wishes to make a comment about this section of the law or the bill that we're proposing?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I had a question for the superintendent before he walked away.
Oh.
Oops. Getting your steps in.
Getting your steps in, Superintendent. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Superintendent, thank you. I just wanted to ask, in regards to my earlier question, I don't know if you have the language in front of you, the line 2.16. I'm sorry, 2.14. During or in the aftermath of an emergency situation that involves the risk of death or bodily harm to a person, do you have any thoughts on the range of that spectrum? It looks like it's going from the lowest to the most extreme, and it's a heightened risk, I think is the criteria. Oh, no, just risk. No, heightened risk is the next line down. So it's just risk, which is not even heightened risk. So it's a very low threshold, and then we're talking bodily harm. So if you could, Mr. Chair and Superintendent, if you could just weigh in, what is your thoughts on the bodily harm lowest criteria and potentially raising that to substantial bodily harm or great bodily harm?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, in this instance, for this particular section of the subdivision, the discussion surrounded that there needed to be more than just simply in the aftermath of an emergency. It was an attempt actually to restrict that it wouldn't be used in any emergency situation, that it wasn't necessarily intended to be a range between bodily harm and death. They would use the definitions that were already in statute for those definitions for bodily harm, and risk of death, I think, is self-explanatory. But it wasn't intended to provide a broad range. It was actually intended to be a limiting factor, and that it wouldn't be used in any emergency. There would have to be some risk to individuals, and those are the definitions we did collectively agreed upon.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the feedback there. And I think that would warrant potentially some future discussion if it is intended to be a narrowing factor to raise that from right now it's the lowest threshold of bodily harm, potentially raising that to a level of substantial bodily harm. But again, future discussion, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Moeller.
I think I'd learn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just add, that was an issue that I had brought up last time about the words that had been used before. I actually like the addition of bodily harm. And a lot of times it's hard for first responders or law enforcement to know right away if what level of harm they're going to be encountering after an accident. And the case law is the difference between bodily harm, substantially bodily harm, great bodily harm isn't always clear. You could have bruises all over your body, and that might just be considered bodily harm. But you could have a broken tooth, and that could be considered substantial bodily harm. So I actually really like the use of bodily harm in this bill.
Representative Harrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the indulgence. And to Representative Mueller's point, here's where the rubber meets the road. Here's the scenario we're talking. It would be an authorized use to use a drone to capture information on people invading their privacy if there's simply the risk of the lowest threshold bodily harm. So if there's a risk of a bruise in the aftermath of an emergency situation, or not even a bruise, just a red mark, on a person, that's going to justify the use of a drone. And what I'm suggesting is we raise the threshold instead of using bodily harm, use a term already defined in statute, potentially substantial bodily harm. I'm just trying to raise the threshold on the authorized use to capture information on people, not having it be the lowest threshold. So that's all. Again, future discussion. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
And I understand... Mr. Chair, I understand Representative Lucero's concerns on this. I just would add that if I'm standing in the shoes of law enforcement, when they have to triage a situation to decide whether or not they're going to employ certain assets, how many squads, what type of technology, I just don't think we can put them in the position of having to parse between the levels. I just don't know how they do that. I think you got to say there's either a reports of bodily harm or there's not, and they get to the scene, there might not be, too, as well. I mean, it might say, oh, well, we deployed those assets like a UAV or something, and there wasn't. But I think that would put an unreasonable burden on dispatch to sending out whatever for law enforcement to have to make a decision on that. I don't know how they do it, but I get where you're coming from, but I'm satisfied with the current language for that reason.
Okay. Any further discussion? Thank you, Superintendent. Don't leave the room, though. Is there anyone else from the law enforcement community that wishes to speak about the remedy question? I've been hearing a lot of chatter about their opposition or their concern about this particular issue, and I was curious if they actually wanted to go on public record. Thank you for coming down. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, sir. Bill Hutton from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Executive Director.
Andy Skugman, Executive Director of Minnesota Chiefs of Police.
Thank you, gentlemen. My question on the remedy section, I've been hearing, and maybe it's a false rumor, but I've been hearing that there was concern about the remedy portion of our proposal. And we've modified that. Senator Newman has raised questions on it. I'd like to get your opinion on whether or not we're going in the right direction or not.
Well, very simply put, we're concerned about the breadth of it. So anything within Chapter 13 that's already there, we understand, but broadening the breadth of it is concerning.
All right. And Senator Newman raised the question of whether or not the broad language of let's see where it is. Of the language that says obtain all appropriate relief. Senator Newman's contention is that might be a little too broad, and perhaps individual references to possible injunctions or an action to require enforcement. To require enforcement or for specific damages above and beyond what's referenced in Chapter 13. I suppose as a potential plaintiff, you would want to limit any and all references to all appropriate relief. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Again, just simply put, we would be okay with things that already exist within Chapter 13.
All right. Okay. Any other questions for these gentlemen? All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak about this particular bill? The original intent of this meeting was to vote on and hopefully pass this bill as a full recommendation to the legislature. It's the judgment of this chair, based on the discussion at this meeting, that this needs a little bit more work to do. So I'm going to lay this particular bill over, and we will move on to our next order of business. Senator Scott. Representative Scott.
Well, thank you for the promotion or demotion, depending on whose eyes you're looking at that through. But I'm wondering if I was visiting with Mr. Hopkins here from House Research, and he had some clarification on what current law is for ALPRs and body cameras as far as the remedies that are available. And I'm wondering if you might want to call on him and ask him to explain those.
Sure. Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to talk about some of the general remedies that are currently available to a potential plaintiff under Section 13.08. So as we know, the bill says that in addition to remedies available under Chapter 13, a party may bring a civil action against a law enforcement agency to obtain all appropriate relief. So what's kind of the baseline that we're working with under Chapter 13? So under 13.08, an aggrieved party who suffers damage as a result of a violation of the Government Data Practices Act can bring a civil action to recover any damage suffered as a result of the violation, plus costs and reasonable attorney's fees. They can also seek an injunction from the court. And there's also a provision in 13.08 that in the case of a willful violation, the government entity shall be liable to exemplary damages, so essentially punitive damages, of not less than $1,000 or more than $15,000 for each violation. So under Chapter 13 currently, a plaintiff has the ability to recover damages, exemplary damages, and attorney's fees, as well as receive an injunction from the court.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've been looking at the same statute since we started. And it really seems to me that 13.08 more than adequately lays out and outlines the remedies that would be available under this particular bill. I don't see that it is limiting the damages. I know that Representative Lesch had expressed some concern about the limitation of the damages in terms of a breach, but I think 13.08 really does adequately address that. And my suggestion, rather than making a motion today, my suggestion would be is that subdivision 8 be rephrased in the next version to simply provide that a violation, the remedies would be available under 13.8 or Chapter 13. I happen to agree with law enforcement that the phrase all appropriate relief to me is legally ambiguous. And as Representative Lesch indicated, you know, trial lawyers can be pretty inventive in their prayer for relief. And I think law enforcement and the public in general should have a pretty strict guideline as to what kind of relief is appropriate for a violation under this drone bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Scott, or Senator Newman. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to make the point, I think there's a relationship between remedies and retention. You're talking about remedies, what course of action a person may take, and I think it's going to be limited if you're erasing the evidence after 7 days. So again, I would say that as we review this, I think that the retention issue has to be reviewed.
Senator Clausen, did you have any idea, perhaps, based on the short discussion we've had today, what would be the appropriate number of days for retainage?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, again, we've got a real nice review that was done by counsel about in reviewing UAVs, the body cameras, and ALPRs. And even between the body cameras and the ULPRs, there's a discrepancy of 90 days in one case, 60 days in another. I would hate to kind of throw out a number without some additional conversation about that.
All right. Any other further discussion? This bill will be laid over for consideration later. I believe we'll probably need another little working group, so if anyone wants to join us on that, you're more than welcome. We'll be getting a notice out to you. We're going to move on to the next order of business, and that's testimony from the Minnesota Government Data Practice, or regarding the Minnesota Data Practice Act and cloud-based data presentation and discussion. And we'll be asking Mr. Matt Ehling from Minkoji to give us a quick review.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Matt Ehling.
Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ehling, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. With an eye to your clock, Mr. Chairman, I have prepared comments of about 10 minutes that go into detail that I think is sufficient to cover the points I want to make, but I want to make sure you have the 10 minutes to allocate.
All right. Please go ahead.
Okay. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to present on this topic. For those of you who are not familiar with Minkoji, we are an all-volunteer, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization comprised of individuals who use government information, so members of the press, librarians, attorneys, IT professionals, and others. Many of our members frequently use the state's Data Practices Act to request data, and we encounter a variety of issues with its implementation and its use. And so when we encounter problems with public access to government information, we bring those issues to the attention of the legislature, as the legislature has the final authority to remedy those issues through amending the act. Today, I'd like to speak specifically about issues involving electronic cloud-based data. Some of these issues emerged during a Data Practices Act request that involved the state of Minnesota's bid for Amazon's second corporate headquarters. As you may recall, the state was closely involved in preparing that bid in late 2017. And in October of that same year, an organization called Public Record Media made a request for that bid, which sought the bid based on its value to the public to understand what the state had offered to Amazon during that bid process. Ultimately, that led to litigation because state agency Deed did not disclose the bid in response to the initial request. So for purposes of clarification, Public Record Media is a separate organization from Minkoji, but it's one on which I also serve as a volunteer member. So Minkoji's board, we've taken note of the problems and potential problems that have arisen from the intersection of the Data Practices Act and cloud-based data, and those are the issues we want to bring to this committee today. I have prepared a packet for this presentation that you may want to reference as we proceed through. So starting on page one, I want to note by saying that
members, now that the mic's on, there is a packet in your, or a reference in your packets regarding what Mr. Ehling is referencing right now. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to begin by noting that our state's Government Data Practices Act was specifically formulated to permit broad-based public access to government data. The statute, as you know, has a public presumption regarding government data unless that data is otherwise classified by state statute or federal law. As you can tell from the name, the Data Practices Act was formulated in part by information technology professionals because it makes reference to data rather than records in the name of the law. And this stemmed from problems that arose from a 1968 Minnesota Supreme Court case that had narrowed the definition of what official records were under the Official Records Act, and it had caused problems for public access to government information. So the legislature in 1979 enacted the Data Practices Act, which regulates data at its most basic level, the data element level. It also very broadly defines government data to encompass all data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by any government entity, regardless of its physical form, storage media, or conditions of use. And Mr. Don Gemberling, who sits on our board and who was one of the chief architects of the Data Practices Act, has noted in the past that that language was specifically designed to address access to electronic government information, which had been emerging in government use during the 1970s. And so electronic data is at the center of what I want to discuss today, and it's worth noting that in our current era, electronic government data has many and varied forms. It's not only government data stored on servers that are owned by the government or possessed by the government entities, but it can also include third-party data stored on computer systems halfway across the world. So examples would include third-party email solutions such as Gmail, which you may be familiar with, where email messages are transmitted from and received by computer servers owned by Google, rather than by any government entity who happens to be using the Gmail platform. Other examples include body camera footage used by Minnesota law enforcement agencies. And contracts with body camera vendors generally not only cover the body cameras themselves, but also generally cover packages of cloud-based data storage through which the law enforcement entities can transmit data to the cloud or receive data from the cloud. And that's housed on third-party servers rather than government servers in many instances. So I've used this term cloud-based data a few times, and I want to provide you with a base definition of what I'm talking about, because in its simplest form, cloud-based data is data maintained on a remote computer that can be accessed from a user's local computer. And in order to view or have access to this remotely stored data, the data first has to be transmitted from the remote computer where it's stored and then received by the local user, such as when a city employee who uses Gmail opens up an email message. They have received that email message, thus making it government data under the logic of the Data Practices Act definition of government data. As I've already mentioned, this broad definition can open up the possibility that government data is stored on non-governmental devices, and I would note that there are multiple Data Practices Act advisory opinions interpreting the statute that have held as much over time. Now, one of the recurring problems that users of open records laws have faced is a problem we call gamesmanship. So this is the government's use of novel legal theories to avoid disclosing what would otherwise be public information in the face of a data request or open records request. And gamesmanship is a problem that's emerged in relation to all kinds of information platforms, but our era of cloud-based data provides many more opportunities for legal games to be played. And we've seen this in other states, both in Florida and next door in Wisconsin. There have been lawsuits brought over access to data stored in Dropbox. Dropbox is essentially rented server space that you can house digital documents on, and then you have a permission to access those documents through the Dropbox system. So in both Florida and Wisconsin, public officials had placed information within Dropbox accounts, and then when they got public records requests for that information, they said that, well, I'm sorry, we can't provide that information to you because it's not covered by our state's public records law. And in both of those cases, the lawsuits resulted in the disclosure of those records in Florida and Wisconsin. Now, I would note that Minnesota faced its own version of this scenario starting in 2017 when Public Record Media requested the state of Minnesota's Amazon bid. And this was done in order to discover what offers or enticements or representations the government had made to the private company Amazon. The request for the bid was denied, and it ultimately led to litigation. Now, I would note here that the Amazon bid has since been released. I have a copy of it here in case anyone is interested in seeing it. And this release stemmed at least in part from a change of management in the governor's office, in the attorney general's office, and at Greater MSP, the private entity that was working with the state to formulate this bid. But there were underlying issues that emerged during the request and the litigation to obtain this bid that this committee deserves to understand so that similar problems do not emerge in the future. Pages 6 through 16 of your packet chart the course of the data request that was made to state agency Deed for the state's Amazon bid. And that initial request sought both the final bid document as well as email correspondence showing how the state and Greater MSP worked together to compile the bid. On page 7, you'll see that a few weeks after that request was submitted, Deed produced essentially two documents. One was a cover sheet that was signed by Governor Dayton, as well as by the majority and minority leaders of the Minnesota legislature. Also included in Deed's initial disclosure was a two-page letter from Deed to Amazon setting out economic incentives that were available to the company under existing law. And in disclosing these documents, Deed noted that these are the only documents Deed possesses that are responsive to the request, and further noted that only Greater MSP held the final bid. And one obvious question that emerged at that time was, why does the state itself not hold a copy of the bid? This is a bid the state was a party to, and they had made representations to a private company about economic development matters. So why did the state not hold the final bid? Later, once Deed produced the emails responsive to PRM's request, it became clear that there was other Amazon-related data that Deed was privy to. If you see on page 9, you'll see a copy of an email sent from Greater MSP to Deed in which an employee of Greater MSP states that she will be opening, quote, a folder on Box, our file sharing system, as a repository for documents, unquote. She then asks for the email addresses of people who want access to the Box portal. And Box, I would note, is similar to Dropbox in function, which we've already discussed. On page 10, you'll see an email from a Deed employee working on the Amazon project, who tells a Greater MSP employee that she was, quote, looking at the Box files, and it looks like you guys have been putting together a final package. It looks good, unquote. She then offers suggestions on how to improve the Amazon bid. And this email was sent from Deed 2 days before the bid itself was submitted. So because of the existence of these email exchanges, a second data request was made for the bid, the final bid document, as well as for drafts, since the emails indicated Deed's review of at least drafts of the bid through the Box system. In a letter that accompanied the second request, Deed was specifically informed that its review of Amazon materials through the Box created government data, since such digital materials had been received by Deed. The agency, however, countered and said that the bid and the drafts were never collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated by Deed. If you turn to page 12, I would further note that other emails released by the agency explicitly indicated that Deed was not planning to disclose the Amazon bid. As you'll see on page 12, the agency told an employee of the city of Invergrove Heights that the bid would not be released at this time out of concern that if it was distributed, the bid could be provided to the media through an open records request. And I would emphasize again that this is public information. And if a public records request had come in, the agency would be obligated legally to disclose it. So litigation ensued, and during that litigation, the Attorney General's office, who was defending Deed and these arguments were made by the AG's office under its previous management, they doubled down on the argument that the Box data was not subject to the Data Practices Act, even though one of the state's own affidavits submitted in the case explicitly noted that a Deed employee had viewed folders and files related to the Amazon project. The AG argued that since the Deed employees had not downloaded the files onto Deed's own computers, that the files were not government data and could not be accessed through data practices requests. And so despite the fact that Deed employees necessarily had to receive these documents and digital data from the Box in order to even view them, a district court judge adopted the government's argument and granted dismissal and summary judgment in favor of Deed. An appeal followed to the Court of Appeals, which was joined by a dozen amicus parties, and many of these parties wrote to share their concerns about the negative implications of the district court's ruling, noting that the court order essentially provided a roadmap for how to evade the Data Practices Act through the use of cloud-based storage. Now, by early 2019, as I mentioned, new management took the helm at the state as well as a greater MSP, and before the written filings were due in the Court of Appeals, the bid was released, which I have noted we take as a very positive development and positive sign. The disclosure also included a batch of raw materials submitted by cities and counties, and this thus ended the case and mooted the appeal. So while the final bid did not reveal large subsidies offered to Amazon, as was the case in many other states, the final bid document did show, as you'll see in your packet, what individual cities and counties had offered in the way of land parcels, lower no-interest loans, promises to pursue TIF districts, and other representations that the citizens of those localities had an indisputable right to know about. So going forward, this dispute over the access to the Amazon bid could have one of two possible outcomes on public access to government information. On one hand, government entities could look at the litigation and the subsequent release of the bid and see that the use of cloud-based file storage as a mean to conceal public data could face resistance and may ultimately be unsuccessful if challenged. On the other hand, there's at least one district court opinion now supporting the proposition that Box or other cloud-based data storage is beyond the reach of the Data Practices Act. And while this lower court ruling is not precedential, those who wish to evade the act through digital storage now have a legal authority that they can point to. So erasing the possible effect of that district court ruling will require either further litigation on this point and an appellate court decision down the line, or else legislative language specifically designed to nullify any reliance on that ruling. So going forward, no government entity can construe government data to be more narrow than what the statute's broad definition ultimately requires. So these are issues we wish to bring to the committee for the committee's discussion. I'd be happy to take any questions on the specifics. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ealing, I didn't track this very closely while it was happening. I only read what I did in the newspaper articles like everyone else. And thank you for the presentation on this. Throughout your presentation, my mind goes primarily to having to deal with the Timber Jay bill back in 2016. If you recall, the Ely Unified School District built a school or schools, outsourced the contract to Johnson Controls. Johnson Controls further subbed it out to various contractors and denied Marshall Helmberger the right to see the data based on the fact that those subcontractors were not government entities and so they weren't subject to the Data Practices Act. The Supreme Court in November of that year said, well, yeah, it's not the statute that this legislature passed is not written into the contract, so we're not going to apply the statute as written because they didn't write it into the contract, which I thought was absurd. So we corrected the language in the 2016 session on that. And with this, I didn't read the district court opinion. How does that district court opinion jibe with all the work that we did in 2016 on the Timber Jay bill saying governmental purpose is governmental purpose and that's public data? Now, the HMOs, as I understand it, are hiding behind trade secret or proprietary information or however it is that they want to do that. Other entities will do that as well, but how is it that they get around that interpretation? Or am I just looking at this in the wrong way? Because, for example, you would cite it on page 11 that they're saying that this is not government data at all, as I understand it, or are they making that claim?
Mr. Ely.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Let me speak to your question in two parts. So the presentation I just gave is in regard to the question of whether the government entity itself had received or maintained data from the box pertinent to the Amazon bid. So in the litigation, that was one strain of the litigation involving the defendant deed, the state agency. What I haven't detailed in this presentation is that there was another defendant named in the litigation. That was Greater MSP, the partner with the state, that had worked on the bid as well. And that gets into the 1305 sub 11 issues you're talking about. So in the litigation, it was unclear, based upon what data was in the box at what time, who had the actual final bid as opposed to drafts. So that's why there were two separate defendants in the litigation, with the hopes that through discovery, it could be discovered who had the final bid. Okay. Now, Greater MSP, their defense in regard to your question was that they did not have a contract with the state to produce the bid. And in litigation that has come on the books since the Timberjay opinion, there have been a couple different issues that have arisen in regard to definitions in 1305 subdivision 11. One is the question of what is a contract, and who has a contract with a government entity to perform a government function, and the second is what is a government function. The case in regards to government function that is always cited in these cases is a case called WDSI, and that has a fairly limited definition of what a government function is. So a lot of defendants in these cases can take shelter under the WDSI decision as a way to say, well, what we did is not a government function. So the question of the contractual language, what is a contract, who has a contract, and the question of what is a government function would be two other areas the legislature may want to look at in that 1305 sub 11 context.
Understood. Mr. Chair, this causes me great concern for various reasons. I think about back to that Timberjay bill. It uniformly denied the right of Minnesotans to know how their taxpayer dollars are being spent, and that is a core function of legislative oversight. I mean, it's a basic job that we do here. Whether you agree with, you know, where the money's being spent on one area versus another area, you still get to know and see where it goes in order to have the argument. So this denies us even the ability to have the argument, which should be, a major concern. And it's a bipartisan concern for Minnesotans as well. So my question is, do you see other areas, you know, outside that Timberjay situation or the Amazon bid that are major areas that prevent us from seeing how those dollars are spent or how are they're proposed to be spent?
Thank you, Representative Lesch. I think both of those examples, issues that arose from Timberjay and the issues that arose from the Amazon bid, those provide the possibility that government entities could try to evade the Data Practices Act through, contracting with a third party, but not explicitly having a written contract or even an implicit contract. That was the issue with the Amazon litigation, is that an implied contract is a contract under Minnesota law. But in order to prove all of the elements of the contract, including, there are three or four, you may need to go into depositions in order to prove all of the elements, such as consideration, what was promised between the parties. And that was what was unable to happen in the Amazon case, because a dismissal happened so early.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? I want our members to realize that as we've talked about other government policies regarding data by government agencies, political subdivisions, we have had a lot of discussion in recent years regarding the cost of retaining information. The political subdivisions of cities and counties, when we ask them to hold that information for a certain period of time that we think is reasonable, we always get the argument, oh, it costs too much money, or it's too difficult, or we have to buy all this infrastructure. So we've looked at other things such as the cloud. Well, this raises a serious question of whether or not the cloud is a secure piece of infrastructure to maintain our data. Now, perhaps it can be cured by legislative action. If we do use the cloud in the future, it has to be done on the rules that we make. And so right now, I don't think we have rules. So this revelation that's found by Minkoji is vitally important for our policy discussions into the future, and it probably needs a little bit more ferreting out, Mr. Ealing. I know I'm going to have a number of questions to ask you offline here, not today, but sometime in the near future, and Representative Lesch is going down the same path that I am thinking of going down too. So thank you for that. It's very important for us as a subcommittee to take this to heart and try and determine what we can do in the next session to see if we can plug some of the potential holes that may even violate state policy that we've already put into law. So thank you, Mr. Ealing. I don't think there's any other further discussion on this issue. And as a result, we stand adjourned. Thank you.